Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. We are nearly halfway through the cesarean portion of every year. The 2 months named after the Roman dictators, Julius and Augustus. I suppose if Donald Trump were to be allowed to revise the calendar, our months would be Trumpuary and Trump Arch, like the Arch of Trump, Trump Rural, Trump Bulai, Trump Ember 1, 2, and 3, Trump Tober. Trump is not simply a presumptuous and corrupt demagogue. He does at least possess what might be considered a genuine historical sense of governance, that of a despot, a Caesar, a Hitler, a Nero. He publicly pronounces his political foes as vermin. We pledge to you, Trump says to his supporters, that we will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country. And Trump says implacably that immigrants coming into the USA are, quote, poisoning the blood, unquote. They are, he says, prisoners, murderers, drug dealers, mental patients, and terrorists, the worst they have. Animals, he repeatedly calls immigrants. They are not human. They are animals, quote, unquote. And he calls his political foes vermin. We pledge to you, Trump says to his fellow Americans, obviously leaving out the female half of the citizenry, that we will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and the radical leftist thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country, quote, unquote. It is not beyond imaginable, as a result of basically totalitarian presidential rulings incessantly being crammed down the public esophagus, that Trump's intent is to incite a new civil war with the consequences exceedingly more dire than the previous such conflict 164 years ago. And it is about time that average Americans acknowledge that Donald Trump is a traitor to the USA, and certainly the mouthpiece of America, with a K, its wealthier classes, who insist average Americans are their underlings as well as their political minions. And it might not be simply coincidental that Trump wishes to reopen Alcatraz prison, which just might become his own version of Devil's Island for incarceration of his political foes. And it might not be too unlikely that his first prisoner would be a previous president he seems to loathe and has publicly demeaned politically and racially, Barack Obama, the USA's only black president so far. And now I would like to read something that I wrote for my newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle. An Assumption of Freedom. July is a month celebrated as the birthday of the United States of America and its founding principles of liberty and justice for all. The larger voices loudly proclaim the USA as the freest, most wonderful country on earth, and unfurl the flags of worldly preeminence and godly jingoism. Smaller voices disagree, which is not to say the ideals of liberty and justice for all are not articulate in the nation, or that their intent is less than political and personal freedom, and something akin to equality under the law, however discriminatory its actual practice, for everybody, now in the future, who live within its geospace. The persistent conundrum is that the actuality is far less than advertised, that neither freedom nor equity is the daily reality for millions of Americans who are governed instead as if they live in a police state because they are poor or are of a minority race, that the old evils of worth measured by wealth, gender, and race continually and perversely undercut the foundations the nation claims to stand upon and believe in. The oldest struggle after survival is for freedom, of being part of a community, not enslaved by it, the eternal, pitiless struggle between haves and have-nots, the despairing rage of those condemned to live bitterly wretched lives in the shadows and as menials to the economic and politically powerful few who are in their turn angrily terrified by this rage. History shrieks with the pain of injustice, only briefly muffled by excesses of gross brutality. Sometimes the oppressed overthrow the lords and bosses, but elites always rise in even the most originally classless societies. If the American Revolution is accepted as more than a revolt of colonial bourgeoisie, and that it gave birth to an entirely egalitarian society in which the common citizenry had a chance to be their own rulers, it should also be realized that every reform has been bitterly and often bloodily resisted and only adopted with great reluctance. Reforms that have been ratified are usually countered with vicious backlash and unrelenting reversion. Vernon Parrington believed that American history has been, quote, largely a struggle between the spirit of the Declaration of Independence and the spirit of the Constitution, the one primarily concerned with the rights of man, and that's a quote, the other more practically concerned with the rights of property, also a part of that same quote. Parrington could not understand why intelligent Americans confused the two and thought of them as complementary. Their unlikeness is unmistakable, Parrington wrote, in Main Currents of American Thought. The one, a classical statement of the French humanitarian democracy, the other an organic law designed to protect the minority under Republican rule, quote, unquote. Historians have long debunked his ideological division of the nation's two most important documents. Yet, as early as the 1820s, Alexis de Tocqueville observed, as R.R. Palmer wrote, quote, that equality was one of the most fundamental ideas of the United States, but he also thought that the American Revolution had been of little importance of in producing this spirit of equality, unquote. Those two classes form a single system, Henry Adams wrote, and that system is the price at which the proletarian is to be bought and sold, the bread and circuses. And that was Henry Adams. George Bernard Shaw. A government that robs Peter to pay Paul can always count on the support of Paul. The obsession for world power, which is America's self-proclaimed manifest destiny, has given it the myopic paradox of patriotic corruption. General Eisenhower said in his farewell speech as president in 1961, every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies in a final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and not clothed. And that was Ike. Nationalism, a packaged product that disguises inequities and rot within the nation, while simultaneously promoting the imperial ambitions of a powerful and avaricious minority, is a prerequisite for expansion, primarily economic colonialism in this new millennium, and ideologies, which are fictions, are yet justifications for tyrannies and terrorisms, large and small. The greater cost is the ultimate loss of liberties in the holy names of national defense and national security. Government hides its clandestine acts against foreign nations and its own citizens under official secrets classifications, which deny access to the citizenry. Operating away from public scrutiny and on behalf of the narrow interests of the elite few, the government cloaks its corruption with pieties of patriotism and the blessings of God. Our cultural pashas proselytize our obviously superior and enlightened supremacy to a wary and suspicious world, while subverting opposition at home to our post-Cold War mode of Pax Romana. War is the enemy of democracy, Howard Zinn says unequivocally. He might add that militarism leads both to war and domestic subordination and is as much the nemesis of freedom. The assumption of freedom is that the average human being is intelligent and inspired by compassion, and that most people will think and act reasonably most of the time. The usual assumption of government is the common citizenry is unintelligent, primitive, and brutal, and must be shielded from its own perfidious nature. The tendency of government is to rule, and it is a parasite. Government must, by the implication or force of its sovereignty, feed upon and subtract the political liberties, rights, and powers of those it rules. It is the responsibility of the people to always contain the power of their government, which, without that restraint, will relentlessly take away power from the people. In the past century, the U.S. government has usurped much power for itself, some of it for the betterment of the people, such as civil rights laws, but also much of it against the people, such as the rule of terror, secrecy, and doubt that characterized the Cold War and nuclear arms race with the now defunct Soviet Union and the empirical presidency of Trump. The idea of the authority of law is a recognition by most of us that a few of us will cheat, rob, murder, and otherwise make life uncomfortable for the rest. A majority desires protection from the psychopathy of an avaricious minority. For exactly the same purpose, to protect us from predatory or cruel government, the political freedom and power of the common citizenry has been made the law of this nation. Yet a government of the people is assumed to also be a government for the people, so it is entrusted to act in the people's behalf to prevent or correct the excesses of monopolistic and unprincipled private interests, which is in contrast to the current era of virulent capitalism. Former President Reagan was wrong when he said that a free government must be free from government. The dismantling of government protections, which has accelerated since his administration, alters government's role from acting as benefactor and protector of civil rights and liberties to its more ominous nature of guardian and enforcer of the reigning status quo, which is increasingly articulated by the wealthy elite and the religious right. Freedom implies a mature citizenry, while the nature of authority requires that no one grow up. To be free and remain that way is a large responsibility, and many people don't want it. Political freedom insists upon the value of the individual, but the accelerated complexity of American society is constructed on aggregates and consensus and makes the contributions and usefulness of each of us less valuable. Our thinking and sense of self-worth are critically affected. An individual and ultimately collective sense of personal and political helplessness settles in. Our freedoms seem to be only wishful lies, bedtime tales told by those we democratically select to Alka-Seltzer our minds of thought, our responsibility. Reality is treated as event, which translates into what entertains. Almost everyone seems apprehensive of the period we are trying to live through and of this new century we warily step into, an unscripted frontier without horizons, already a quarter of its length. Zestful prophecies of humanity uber alles are proclaimed, as are apocalyptic visions. The law of parsimony is not helpful. The simplest answer is probably the wrong one. If God is dead, who is there but Homo Jones to believe in, the great 19th century idea that made the 20th century a maelstrom of hubris and horror? From top to bottom, the whole system is a fraud, Henry Adams wrote. All of us know it, laborers and capitalists alike, and all of us are consenting parties to it. He thought the entire society would go to rack if we really lay hands of reform on our rotten institutions, quote unquote. Former news director of KGW-TV in Portland, he died in 1990, wrote that the federal and legislative branches of the U.S. government are so corrupt that reform requires insurrection. James Madison argued in 1791, when he introduced the Bill of Rights to the Constitution as its first 10 amendments, that, quote, the people, not the government, possess the absolute sovereignty, unquote. Abraham Lincoln said that if the people retain their virtue and vigilance, no administration, quote, by any extreme of wickedness or folly, unquote, can very seriously injure the governmental concepts of our founding ancestors. If we wish to take hope and some encouragement in the long struggle ahead to right the balance of power in this country, perhaps it is not too late to agree with James Boyle, who wrote in the New York Times, one reason we have a democracy is because people make unspeakably stupid decisions without it. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. In this celebrative month of liberty and freedom, I came across an article in the Daily Astorian I have saved from 1993, March 9th of that year. Old Glory put to a new use as condom logo. A condom company can use an American flag shaped like an unfurled condom as its logo, the U.S. trademark trial and appeal board has ruled. Old Glory Condoms of Provincetown, Massachusetts, appealed after the trademark office refused in 1991 to register the logo, saying the design would scandalize or shock too many people. The company had argued that its design had been singled out for political reasons, noting that the U.S. flag is incorporated into the logos of thousands of products. The real scandal is not my trademark, but the fact that the examining attorney was more scandalized by the trademark than by the AIDS crisis to which I sought to respond, company founder Jay Critchie said. And that's from the Daily Astorian, March 9th, 1993. On today's date, in 1929, President Herbert Hoover renounced war as an instrument of American foreign policy.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.